Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now we continue our 30 Issues election series with issue number 20, How to Keep Big Money from Destroying Our Democracy While Citizens United is Still in Effect. Overturning it through a constitutional amendment or the Supreme Court reversing itself is really unlikely. So we'll compare Clinton, Trump, and some of the experts on what to do within the current reality of this constitutional ruling as interpreted by the Supreme Court, or was made by the Supreme Court. And let's listen to some history. The issue goes at least as far back as President Theodore Roosevelt at the beginning of the 20th century, as the Gilded Era gave way to the Progressive Era, and Roosevelt saw how much the super rich of the new industrial era were spending to influence politics. But nothing much was done. In fact, in 1947, President Harry Truman vetoed a bill called the Taft-Hartley Act because it would ban unions, corporations, and interstate banks from donating to political campaigns. In other words, Truman, a liberal Democrat in most ways, thought those donations were a good thing.
The Taft-Hartley bill goes so far that it would threaten fundamental democratic freedoms. One provision undertakes to prevent political contributions and expenditures by labor organizations and corporations. This provision would forbid a union newspaper from commenting on candidates in national elections. It might well prevent an incorporated radio network from spending any money in connection with the national convention of a political party. It might even prevent the League of Women Voters, which is incorporated, from using its funds to inform its members about the record of a political candidate. I regard this provision of the Taft-Hartley bill as dangerous, a challenge to free speech, as a dangerous challenge to free speech and our free press.
President Harry Truman in 1947. How about that? It's the same argument we hear today for Citizens United, isn't it? Corporate union and big bank spending on campaigns is First Amendment freedom of speech. So Truman vetoed Taft-Hartley, but Congress overrode the veto and it became law anyway. So in the following election, 1952, the legendary union leader George Meany went on television to endorse the Democratic candidate Adlai Stevenson, who promised to help repeal Taft-Hartley and allow unions to resume spending on political campaigns. It was the first time the AFL had endorsed a candidate, and Meany was asked about it by an interview named William Bradford Huey on the CBS News program called Long Jeans Chronoscope.
Now, do you think that you have the labor movement and the AFL has politically lost ground since 1948, so it requires you to endorse this candidate party?
I think that's true. I think we have. I think we've lost ground in the sense that our influence in the national capital, in the legislature, and in the legislatures of the various states has been lessened since 1948.
It's in the states itself, though, rather than in the federal government.
Oh, in both. In the national capitals, no question, our influence has been lessened since 1948.
So, with the election of Stevenson that you expect to regain some ground that you think that you've lost, then?
Yes, we feel if Stevenson is elected, that he will take in with him, and of course, political history proves that we're right in this instance, that he will take in with him a Congress dominated by his party. And, of course, if General Eisenhower is elected, he will take in a Republican Congress. And we feel that our chances are better to repeal the Taft-Hartley law and get a law that's fair to both labor and management and the general public if a Democratic Congress is in Washington.
Labor leader George Meany in 1952. Of course, Adlai Stevenson lost that election to Eisenhower, and Taft-Hartley remained the law of the land. By the way, we weren't talking about very much money being spent on campaigns in those days by today's standards. In 1960, when John F. Kennedy was running, he was asked on Face the Nation if the Kennedy family fortune was tipping the scales. Listen to the little numbers he replies with to that question.
I would say in a state like Wisconsin that it would probably run 100 and $35,000 to $40,000. That's my judgment about what the campaign would probably run in toto, including every conceivable expense that you might have. It might run that high. Now, if you hire a half hour or 15 minutes of statewide TV, it costs you approximately $5,000. If you hire a statewide, a spot, cost you 10 seconds or so, might cost you $200. I must say, gentlemen, TV is not very inexpensive. Newspaper advertising is not inexpensive. Billboards, nor is mailing inexpensive. If you have a million homes in the state and you try to cover it by mail, of course, that costs some money. I think you should realize, however, that the Brookings Institute states that President Eisenhower's campaign in 1952, when costs were lower, was $2,500,000. Taft, it said, exceeded that. And Governor Stevenson's in 1956, according to Brookings, cost more than $1,500,000. It is unfortunate that campaigns cost some money, but I must say that I think ours is in a reasonable expenditure, which is easily ascertainable. You can tell exactly what we've spent it on, and we're going to report it.
$200 for a TV political ad in 1960. Quaint. Interesting that JFK there in 1960 was talking about it being okay to spend money as long as it's transparent where it's coming from. That's an issue today, and we'll hear that come back. But if you think the 1960 campaign was low cost compared to today, 1976 was even cheaper. Here's Jimmy Carter, who won that year, remembering it here on this program last year.
Well, when I ran against the incumbent president, Gerald Ford, neither he nor I raised any money from contributions. And the same thing happened 4 years later when I ran against against Governor Reagan.
Any money?
We didn't raise any money. No, we just used a $1 per person checkoff that came from individual taxpayers. We didn't have any private contributions to our campaign. And nowadays, with this stupid decision that the Supreme Court has made on Citizens United, it's almost impossible to imagine a Democratic or Republican nominee being successful without being able to raise $200 or $300 million. And so those people that give that enormous amount of money are mostly wealthy people, and they want something in response. And I think that adversely affects the tenor of the election, the essence of democracy and freedom, and also distorts the decisions that are made later on by elected officials, including the president and including the members of Congress.
Jimmy Carter, on this show last year, he referred in that clip to the $1 checkoff. His election year, 1976, was the first time Americans could voluntarily give $1 on our federal income tax returns designated for public financing of campaigns. In 1994, Congress adjusted it for inflation to $3. If presidential campaigns or candidates agree to certain spending limits, they get that money as federal matching funds. Now, as we'll hear, Barack Obama has led the way to destroying that system. In 2008, John McCain did agree to participate in the public financing system, but Obama broke precedent with Democrats who came before him and did not. He made this announcement in a campaign video in June 2008.
Hi, this is Barack Obama. I have an important announcement, and I wanted all of you, the people who built this movement from the bottom up, to hear it first. We've made the decision not to participate in the public financing system for the general election. This means we'll be foregoing more than $80 million in public funds during the final months of this election. It's not an easy decision, especially because I support a robust system of public financing of elections. But the public financing of presidential elections, as it exists today, is broken, and we face opponents who become masters at gaming this broken system. John McCain's campaign and the Republican National Committee are fueled by contributions from Washington lobbyists and special interest PACs. We've already seen that he's not going to stop the smears and attacks from his allies running so-called 527 groups, who will spend millions and millions of dollars in unlimited donations. From the very beginning of this campaign, I've asked my supporters to avoid that kind of unregulated activity and join us in building a new kind of politics. And you have. Instead of forcing us to rely on millions from Washington lobbyists and special interest PACs, you fueled this campaign with donations of $5, $10, $20, whatever you can afford.
Barack Obama in 2008, a long way from Jimmy Carter in 1976. Obama stated his rationale there as defending against special interest PACs and their big money, but also he had much greater campaign fundraising potential than McCain from big and small donors alike, and he wanted to use it. In 2012, neither Obama nor Romney agreed to the public financing limits. We're still debating that concept today, right? Whether public money, taxpayer money, if it dominates campaign spending, prevents the private sector from corrupting democracy, everything from the Koch brothers' oil interests to foreign donors to the Clinton Foundation. But questions about money buying influence aren't totally new. Did you know that there was a scandal back in 1952 that almost cost Richard Nixon his spot on the ticket as Eisenhower's running mate? It was over $18,000 given to him for his political use. Now, in those days, the New York Post was a liberal newspaper, and they ran a headline, "Secret Rich Men's Trust Fund Keeps Nixon in Style Far Beyond His Salary." But Nixon successfully defended himself in an address that came to be known as the Checkers speech because of another gift he got at the time, a dog named Checkers. Was it morally wrong for Senator Nixon to take that $18,000?
I say that it was morally wrong if any of that $18,000 went to Senator Nixon for my personal use. I say that it was morally wrong if it was secretly given and secretly handled. And I say that it was morally wrong if any of the contributors got special favors for the contributions that they made. And now to answer those questions, let me say this. Not 1 cent of the $18,000 or any other money of that type ever went to me for my personal use. Every penny of it was used to pay for political expenses that I did not think should be charged to the taxpayers of the United States.
Nixon in 52, the Checkers speech. Here's the Checkers part, by the way.
It was a little cocker spaniel dog in a crate that he'd sent all the way from Texas. Black and white, spotted. And our little girl, Tricia, the six-year-old, named it Checkers. And you know, the kids, like all kids, love the dog. And I just want to say this right now, that regardless of what they say about it, we're going to keep him.
He knew how to tug on your heartstrings, that Richard Nixon. But interesting that his defense in 1952 was that the money was not corrupt precisely because it was a political donation. I think we might look at that differently today. When Nixon was president 20 years later, he had become so cynical about campaign money buying influence that he joked in a phone call that he didn't think would be made public about raising the allowable price of milk as payback for donations from the milk industry. This is widely perceived now as a quid pro quo that took place at that time for $2 million in dairy industry donations. As with other Nixon White House tapes that we played in this series, you can barely understand the words, but I'm going to play it anyway because the historical value is so striking. I'll read you the transcript first. He says, it's 85, and his aide Schultz says, we're not suddenly going for 505, and I would guess 498. His aide Connolly says, no, we're going for 492. Schultz, 492. That's 85% of parity. That's right. Nixon, fair enough. Someone else said, all right. Ehrlichman, his aide, says, better go get a glass of milk, and everybody laughs. He says, drink it while it's cheap. Ha, 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 drink it while it's cheap. So the Watergate scandal motivated Congress to pass major campaign finance reform in 1974. As the website InfoPlease describes it, limiting the amount of money an individual could contribute to a single campaign to $1,000 and a total of $25,000 to all federal candidates. It also mandated the disclosure of all contributions above $100, required candidates to file campaign finance reports, and implemented public financing of presidential elections. That was the public financing that Jimmy Carter used and Barack Obama rejected. Ironically, the post-Watergate reforms kind of bring us to the modern day horrors of campaign finance. As you heard, they were focused on the direct contributions people could make to the candidates themselves. To get around that, the era of soft money began, so-called independent groups that supported candidates by spending their own money directly in support of the candidate, not giving it to the campaign. This is what the bipartisan McCain-Feingold law tried to correct by closing some of those soft money loopholes. Here's a minute of Senator John McCain arguing for that law in 2001.
Our legislation is simple, bipartisan, and achieves three primary objectives that will go far to reform our electoral system. The bill bans soft money for usage in federal elections. It requires increased disclosure of electioneering communications by so-called independent organizations in a constitutional and clear manner, known as the Snow Jeffords language. It codifies the Supreme Court's Beck decision, a court decision effectively ignored by the previous administration, and now under this act, a decision which would be strictly enforced. After one of the closest elections in our nation's history, there's one thing the American people are unanimous about. They want their government back. We can do that by ridding politics of large, unregulated contributions that give special interests a seat at the table, while average Americans are stuck in the back of the room. The Senate needs to act early on campaign finance reform so we can achieve meaningful reform and restore the public's faith in our government.
So McCain-Feingold passed, and that's what was challenged in Citizens United. Now, if you don't know, Citizens United itself is a conservative activist group. And what was the campaign spending it did that violated McCain-Feingold? They released a movie to attack Hillary Clinton in the 2008 presidential campaign. Here's 7 seconds of the trailer.
She's no Richard Nixon. She's worse.
Vindictive.
Venal. Sneaky.
Intolerant.
Scares the hell out of me.
You get the idea. So was Hillary the movie illegal campaign spending? Yes, until the Supreme Court weighed in after this argument about individual and corporate spending by Citizens United lawyer Ted Olson before the Supreme Court.
Robust debate about candidates for elective office is the most fundamental value protected by the First Amendment's guarantee of free speech. Yet that is precisely the dialogue that the government has prohibited if practiced by unions or corporations, any union or any corporation. The government claims it may do so based upon the Austin decision that corporate speech is by its nature corrosive and distorting because it might not reflect actual public support for the views expressed by the corporation.
Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg followed up.
Mr. Olson, are you taking the position that there is no difference in the First Amendment rights of an individual? A corporation, after all, is not endowed by its creator with inalienable rights. So is there any distinction that Congress could draw between corporations and natural human beings for purposes of campaign finance?
What the court has said in the First Amendment context, New York Times versus Sullivan, Grosjean versus Associated Press, and over again, is that corporations are persons entitled to protection under the First Amendment.
So after that, Justice Ginsburg was one of four who voted against Citizens United's case, but 5 justices voted for it, so it was 5-4. And by that close vote, the heart was cut out of the McCain-Feingold law. Now, remember when we played John F. Kennedy in 1960, saying his expenditures were okay because they were transparent?
It is unfortunate that campaigns cost some money, but I must say that I think ours is in a reasonable expenditure, which is easily ascertainable. You can tell exactly what we've spent it on, and we're going to report it.
Easily ascertainable, he said then. So the transparency of Citizens United-style campaign money is another contentious issue today. Here's President Obama again, speaking in 2010, when he couldn't even get Congress to pass the so-called Disclose Act after Citizens United. The Disclose Act would allow the public to see who's donating to Citizens United-type action funds.
Nobody's saying you can't run the ads. Just make sure the people know who, in fact, is behind financing these ads. And you'd think that reducing corporate and even foreign influence over our elections would not be a partisan issue. But, of course, this is Washington in 2010. And the Republican leadership in the Senate is once again using every tactic and every maneuver they can to prevent the Disclose Act from even coming up for an up or down vote.
So today, thanks to a combination of Congress and the Supreme Court, we have unlimited donations and spending in support or opposition to candidates, from donations to interest groups that can't even be traced to the donors, if the donors and the group so choose. Former Senator Russ Feingold, the other half of McCain-Feingold, came on the show in 2012 and told me the best hope for change is actually to hope the Supreme Court will eventually see the error of its ways.
All they have to say is this was a bad decision, we reconsider, and courts do this all the time. The Supreme Court doesn't do it all the time, but it is so out of line with the law of the last 100 years that I don't think it would be a big deal for the court to say, well, and then they always have a way to sort of say, well, this case is a little different, so this is why it's okay. Believe me, that's the least of their problems.
We'll see. Former Senator Russ Feingold on this program in 2012. And that's our brief audio history of campaign finance politics in our 30 Issues election series, Issue 20, What to Do About Campaign Finance While Citizens United is Still in Effect. Let's talk about some of the history with Fred Wertheimer, who's been a campaign finance reform crusader in Washington, I think since the 1970s. He currently runs the reform group Democracy 21. Hi, Fred. Thanks very much for coming on for this.
Happy to be here.
What's the earliest campaign finance reform battle you were involved with?
The Watergate reforms of 1974.
So how much did I get that part of the history right, in your opinion, that the post-Watergate reforms, which focused on limits directly to candidates, gave us the modern era of Citizens United, where so much of the spending is technically independent of the campaigns as kind of a loophole?
No, I don't think the reforms gave us Citizens United, because the Supreme Court decision that upheld most of those laws knocked out a provision that said that as long as independent expenditures were made independently of the candidates, they could not be regulated. And through a rather long history, we wound up with a decision in Citizens United and then another court decision, lower court, that created the explosion of these so-called super PACs, based on the theory that these PACs make independent expenditures and therefore those cannot corrupt and therefore contributions to those groups cannot corrupt. So it was actually the Supreme Court decision in Buckley in 1976 that ultimately resulted in where we are today. And where we are today is unprecedented in the history of the country. We have extraordinary amounts of money being provided by billionaires and multimillionaires and spent by these independent groups to influence our elections and ultimately influence government decisions in many cases. So we've got an unprecedented kind of problem, although we have faced unprecedented problems in the past. The history of campaign finance it's a cyclical issue. You have problems, you lead to scandals. We had the Watergate scandals, and we had the Watergate reforms. We had the soft money scandals, and we have the soft money reforms, some of which are still effective today. I mean, the biggest change that's occurred is we had a change in the Supreme Court in 2005 and 2006 when Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito joined the court and switched the court from a majority 5-4 majority that was supporting campaign finance laws to a 5-4 majority that has been knocking them down ever since. And that has created the current round of problems, and I would agree with Senator Feingold. We now have an opening on the court, and if a more progressive justice is appointed to the court, I would predict we will see fundamental changes in the court's approach to these issues, and I think we will end up getting rid of Citizens United and other decisions, mm-hmm. because those decisions overturned 40 years of Supreme Court precedent.
So there's a lot at stake in this election, if for no other reason, who gets to sit on the Supreme Court, with Citizens United perhaps hanging in the balance and other things. Pessimists, though, would say that big money's always going to find a way, like water. And so whether it's the post-Watergate reforms, and then in 76, the Buckley versus Valeo ruling comes pretty quickly after that and opens things up again. Or, you know, if hard money is restricted, then they invent soft money, and pick your one. Big money's going to find a way. What do you say?
Well, I say that you can enact reforms that work. We have done that in this country. You have to be vigilant. Efforts are made to break them down. This is a continuum. You don't have ultimate solutions. You have to keep working at this. But let's take the public financing system enacted in 1976. That worked for two decades. And the reason it broke down was that Congress would not change and update it to deal with the fact that the costs of campaigns had exploded. But during that period from 1976 into the 90s, every major party candidate used the system to run for their general election campaigns. Ronald Reagan ran for president in 1984 without holding a single fundraiser for his campaign.
Wow.
And
the Jimmy Carter part of that history was right? They never raised a dollar?
Yes, well, it was for the general election. He had to raise small contributions to get matching funds for the primary. But Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter ran the first presidential election funded by public money, and it was extremely successful in terms of completely changing the way our presidential campaigns were financed. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask how much you blame Barack Obama for having opted out of the campaign finance system, the public finance system, in 2008, as we heard.
Well, he put the final nail in the coffin. But the problem we had had prior to that was we could not get Congress to fix the system so that you reached a point where, in order to get the public funds, you had to agree to a spending limit that was too low. Mm. And if your opponent didn't go into it, or if you were facing outside spending groups, it was not a competitive level. So the problem arose because the system became out of sync with the way modern campaigns were financed. But President Obama certainly made his contribution to ending the system when he first said he would go into the system in 2008 and then changed his position and opted out. But, you know, going to the point you raised earlier, there actually are things you can do within this broken system that will greatly improve it. We can get disclosure of the hundreds of millions of dollars in secret contributions that are funding campaigns and have been since 2010. And we can get all of that information by passing legislation. We can recreate a matching fund system so that congressional and presidential candidates have an alternative way to finance their system and can combat and counter all of the big money being spent independently. We can't stop much of that until the court changes previous decisions, which I believe they will if a more progressive justice is appointed. But we can equip candidates to run for office based on small contributions and public funds channeled to them by citizens making small contributions so that they're not dependent and obligated to this big money. And we actually can shut down some of these super PACs. There are super PACs that only support one candidate. They have been dominant in the presidential elections. And we can, within the Supreme Court decisions, make clear that those super PACs are coordinating with the presidential campaigns and put them out of business. So I believe there are things that can be done, and I do not buy the pessimist view. I never have, that there's nothing you can do here that will work. It will work. There are steps you can take that will work. You can make major reforms in the system that will protect the interests of ordinary Americans. And that's what's at stake here. Because every time you wind up with a system dominated by private money, it is dominated by private money from wealthy individuals or from interest groups. They want something in return, and it is the hundreds of millions of ordinary Americans that lose out in this process.
And that's a great preview of tomorrow's segment, which will be a direct comparison of Clinton and Trump on the question of what to do about campaign finance while Citizens United is still in effect. So for this conversation, we thank Fred Wertheimer, founder and president of the campaign finance reform advocacy group Democracy 21. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure to be with you.
In our 30 Issues election series, Issue 20, what to do about campaign finance while Citizens United is still in effect. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Stay with us.